2nd, 2024. The band includes longtime collaborators, Blue Note Records artist Dave McMurray on sax and Eminem's Oscar-winning collaborator, keyboardist Luis Resto, plus a host of stellar jazz musicians from the city of Detroit. For more information and tickets, visit wheremusicmeetsthesoul.com and kpfk.org.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like.
Both fighters being called to the center ring.
Listen, my comments. Heads up.
I'm Salima Hamoureini, and to start us off today, we're going to go back to August 1st at the 2024 Paris Olympics to a boxing match between Amani Khalif and Angela Karim.
A final welterweight fight of the session between Algeria and Italy. And we're off.
At first, Khalif and Karini weave back and forth, and Karini lands a punch.
Good right hook from Karini. Khalif looking to come with the straight punches to the body of Karini.
And then all of a sudden, Karini walks to the corner of the ring, and she pauses.
Karini just asking to get her head guard tightened in.
She comes back out to fight, and quickly, Khalif lands a punch. It's honestly so fast, I don't even see it.
Solid straight right hand from Khalif there.
And then, all of a sudden, Karini quits. 46 seconds into the match, she retreats to the corner.
Well, demonstrating from Karini. She talks to her corner. She's not happy about something.
She's been shouting, "It's not fair, it's not fair." Meanwhile, Khalif looks sullen and worried.
We'll wait on the results here.
Abandoned. Victorious by abandon. In red from Algeria.
Khalif wins this fight because Karini quits after one punch, less than 1 minute into the fight. But Khalif doesn't look triumphant in this moment. Her face looks confused. This fight, this 46-second match, began a firestorm in this year's Olympics. Almost immediately, commentators flooded Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Khalif, the Algerian fighter, they said, is not a woman. She's secretly a man. They argued that Karini quit because she was hit so hard by a man that she didn't feel as if it was fair to continue. She was in danger during the fight. Elon Musk and J.K. Rowling got involved.
Rowling using incorrect pronouns, tweeting that Khalif was enjoying the distress of a woman he's just punched in the head and whose life's ambitions he's just shattered.
Former President Trump jumped into the fray, saying that if he was elected, he'd forbid men from competing in women's sports. But here's the thing. Imani Khalif isn't a man. That's Khalif speaking out about the controversy later, saying, "I'm a woman. Like any other woman, I was born a woman. I have lived as a woman. I compete as a woman. There is no doubt about that." So why did everybody suddenly become convinced that she was not a woman? That's the topic of today's show. The extreme focus on proving women's identities in sports. And to help us understand what's going on with gender in the Olympics, I sat down with Rose Eveleth.
I am the host and reporter behind a new podcast called Tested, which is about sex testing, past, present, and future, unfortunately, probably.
Rose has been investigating gender testing in sports, especially in track and field, for over a decade. Okay, Rose, so start us off. Why did people start making this accusation that Khalif was a man? Was it based on her appearance? Like, what was it?
So it's a couple of things. I think some people will say things like, well, just look at her, right? Clearly, she doesn't look like a woman, which, of course, is completely subjective. The other thing that's happening here is that last year, in the spring of 2023, the IBA, the International Boxing Association, held a meeting and they disqualified these two boxers, Khalif and Lynn. And they did so because they claimed that these boxers had failed some unspecified laboratory test about their gender. And it is still very unclear what test was done. They've gone back and forth. They've said it was testosterone, and then they said, no, no, it's not testosterone, it's chromosomes. It was all very confusing. But in the spring of last year, they disqualified these two boxers. And it was very strange because it was sort of in the middle of an event, the big sort of international tournament for boxing. And so because some people, I guess, knew about this past disqualification, they sort of resurfaced this idea that perhaps Khalif is not somehow a woman, which, of course, is not the case.
And why do they single out Khalif and Lynn?
We don't really know. It's I think, just based on appearance, right? I think it's that they seemed somehow not womanly enough. But it's not clearly written out in the meeting minutes what it was that flagged these two women in particular.
But also, the IBA has had its own controversies, right, which have predated this particular gender scandal. Is there a reason we should be wary of what the IBA claims it discovered during those tests?
Yes. So the IBA is fraught, to put it maybe nicely. The IBA is the International Boxing Association. They used to be known as the AIBA. They've sort of gone through different iterations. And the IBA has been in hot water for many years, since about 2019, because there have been allegations of corruption, of unethical practices, of all sorts of things that actually have nothing to do with sex testing at all. They were already kind of in trouble. And so in 2019, the IOC actually gave them kind of a laundry list of things, saying, look, if you want to maintain your status as the recognized International Federation for Boxing, you need to clean up your act. You got to do this, this, this. And the IBA essentially didn't do those things. And so a couple of months after this meeting at which these two boxers were disqualified, the IOC stripped the IBA of recognition.
The IOC, the International Olympic Committee, has since come out in support of Khalif with a rare, very rare, progressive statement on gender.
They have competed and they continue to compete in the women's competition. They have lost and they have won against other women throughout over the years. But testosterone is not a perfect test. Many women can have testosterone, which is in what would be called male levels, and still be women and still compete as women. So this panacea, this idea that suddenly you do one test for testosterone and that sorts everything out, not the case, I'm afraid.
And keep those words in mind from the IOC, because that is not how they've normally thought about gender. Rose, so the other thing about the kind of like truly horrifying media obsession with Khalif's gender is that it's not new. And in your podcast, you talk about the earliest Olympics and how this immediately became a problem when the very first women began competing. Can you talk to me a little bit about the history of gender testing in sports?
Yeah, so one of the things I think is the most surprising about the history of sex testing is just how old it is, how long ago we started doing this. So in 1928, it's the first year that women are allowed to compete in track and field. Now, women had been allowed to compete in the Olympics before 1928, but they were only allowed in sports that were deemed at the time more feminine. So things like swimming or tennis. Track and field was seen as the manliest of man sports. If you were a real man, you competed in track and field. And so it's in 1928, when women are allowed to compete, essentially right off the bat, as soon as women hit the track, you hear people talking in newspapers, you know, quotes, all these headlines saying, there is something wrong with these women. That woman looks too muscular. That woman looks too strong. The woman who won silver in the 800 meters in 1928, Hitomi Kinue, who's a Japanese runner, people said things like, you know, she had all the power of a halfback, right? Talking about how they had these muscles. There was something wrong with them. And that sort of begins sex testing. So, you know, you have a couple of anecdotal stories about women being pulled aside. There was a story about Hitomi Kinue being pulled aside and examined. There's a story about Helen Stevens, an American runner, being pulled aside and examined. And then in 1936, you get the first sort of on the books policy for track and field saying that if there are what they called questions of a physical nature, you could take them aside and you could examine them.
Wait, when you say examined, what do you mean?
Yeah, it was purely visual. There's not a lot of good documentation about exactly what test would be done. And I sort of often don't even like to call it a test because really it is a visual exam. It means that you take someone aside and in the best case scenario, you ask them to go to their doctor and ask them to get like essentially a doctor's note that says, you know, we've examined this woman and she's a woman. But in the worst case scenario, you wind up with a sports official taking a woman aside and asking her to, again, get naked so that they can examine her body and make sure that, I guess, her vulva looks correct in some way. And again, this is not written down. They don't write down exactly what they'd be looking for. It's all very vague.
It should be pointed out here that the 1936 Olympics that Rose mentions were the Berlin Olympics, which took place during the height of the Nazi regime in Germany. At the time, there were huge boycotts asking the U.S. to pull out of the games because of the Nazis. But while the persecution of Germany's Jewish population was taking place in the background, what were Olympic officials worried about? If the women were feminine enough. This has always been an underlying worry. Are the women competing feminine and attractive enough for men to want to look at?
Yeah, I mean, Avery Brundage, who is a really critical figure in the period of the 30s, 40s, even to the 50s, he's really the instrumental American sports official who pushes the United States to not boycott the 1936 Nazi Olympics, right? He is the reason largely that the U.S. stays in those games because he had a lot of friends in the Nazi Party and was quite sympathetic to the Nazi cause. You know, he talks fairly explicitly about one of the reasons why he doesn't like women participating in sports is because he finds it unattractive. He does not find it attractive to watch women exert themselves because when you run really hard, you know, you make a weird face and you look like you're trying really hard. And that was just sort of disgusting to him. And he doesn't really mince words about that. He's very straightforward about it.
But even in Nazi Germany, testing was on a case-by-case basis. And that changes in the 1960s.
And then in 1966, rather than abandoning sex testing, the governing body of track and field decides that actually they needed to test every single woman, that doing it on a case-by-case basis wasn't enough. And so they roll out something called the nude parades, which are unfortunately quite what they sound like. Women were asked to go into a room and get naked and be examined by someone, usually a doctor, that they don't know, to make sure that their basically genitals look correct and they looked like a woman. That also was called the peek and poke tests by some of the athletes at the time.
Rose actually managed to interview athletes who underwent the peek and poke tests for their podcast Tested. Here's Carol Martin, who was a young 18-year-old athlete at the time that she competed in Jamaica in 1966 at an international competition.
I remember we were taken under the stands before the competition into a large room and had to pull my pants down in front of this woman so she could see I had a vagina. I remember thinking, what the f*** is this? This seems a little invasive. This seems a little inappropriate.
This part was really astonishing to me in Rose's podcast because men have never undergone this kind of scrutiny, just women. The nude parades were incredibly unpopular for obvious reasons, and they were successfully banned in 1968. But by then, science had progressed, and we were able to start checking for testosterone and for chromosomes, which gave the IOC new tools with which to examine gender.
So between 1968-ish and 1999, every woman who competed at the Olympics had to go into a room, get their cheeks swabbed, and take this chromosome test. And if you passed it, you were given a little card, a certificate of femininity, they were called. And then it would say, like, certified female, check. And you had to bring that with you to every event you wanted to compete at. But so then in 1999, they drop that. And they drop it because there has been truly 30 years, I mean, basically since the very beginning, there have been doctors and experts begging the IOC to drop this test because it is not a reliable test of sex or gender. Having a Y chromosome does not necessarily make you a man. There are some estimates say 1 in 500 women have Y chromosomal material in some or all of their cells. You or I might have Y chromosomes. We might just not know because why would we know that? And so eventually in 99, they drop that test. And then in 2009, you sort of see this pick up again after Caster Semenya, who some people may know, ran in Berlin. And now we're sort of in this testosterone era where rather than thinking that the chromosome is the core thing, now we're really focused on testosterone. So it's been this kind of, I almost like to describe it as like a game of whack-a-mole a little bit, where there's everyone is just searching for this one singular test to tell who's a woman and who's not. And there isn't one. And so you just keep kind of hitting the moles as they pop out of the ground. And each one of them is their own kind of weird little test that we try to do. But there's just no way easily to do this.
Okay, but why can't we find one single test to tell us whether or not someone is a man or a woman? Well, because human sex is a beautifully varied, complicated thing, and there's no easy way to divide the sexes into a binary, no matter how much the IOC wants to. Stay tuned, we're going to dig into what makes a man and what makes a woman, or not, right after the break.
I'm jumping in to remind you that you are listening to Making Contact. If you like today's show and want more information, or if you'd like to leave us a comment, visit us at our new website, focmedia.org. There you can access today's show and all of our prior episodes. Okay, now back to the show.
Welcome back to Making Contact. Today we're talking about sex testing at the Olympics. In the first half of the show, we talked about the history of gender testing in sports and the incredibly invasive way women, not men, have been singled out in order to prove their gender identities. But while we might have social ideas about what makes a man and what makes a woman, in the biological realm, there's no clear binary. And we're back in the second half with Rose Evelyn, host and producer of the podcast Tested, which you can find links to on our website. Rose, there are a lot of components to biological sex that make us, quote, male or female. And I'm just curious, how common are variations? How many of us, for example, who identify as women might have high testosterone, for example, without even knowing?
Yeah, it's a great question that's actually hard to answer because, as you say, most people don't know, right, their chromosomal makeup, their testosterone level, right? Like, most people just don't know that. So we don't really know exactly how common it is, depending on the definition. So there's all sorts of things that can vary in human sex biology. You can have XXY chromosomes. You can have XYY chromosomes. Men can have XX chromosomes. You know, you can have internal testes but also have breasts and a vagina. You can have really high levels of testosterone. Some women have really, really high levels of testosterone, but they have what's called androgen insensitivity, and so they can't actually process that testosterone. So there's sort of a million different variations that can happen here. Intersex advocates sometimes call it sort of a symphony, right? That there's all different instruments that can get played to kind of combine to make whatever your sort of unique biological makeup is. And depending on who you ask and how you define these terms, there are some estimates that say that between 1 and 2% of the population has some kind of variation in their sex biology. So this is not exceedingly rare. It's not a super uncommon thing. And I think, you know, many people would perhaps be surprised to learn their biology. Actually, I was just talking to a neighbor of mine, and she told me that recently she was diagnosed with high testosterone, and she had her whole life, she had no idea. And she was joking. She was like, I'm not good at sports. You know, it didn't give me any kind of advantage. And so I think this is just actually far more common than people realize.
And then, of course, gender and sex are different concepts. You can be assigned one gender at birth, but know yourself to have a different identity than the one that you were assigned. The difference between sex and gender didn't exist as a concept back in the 20s and 30s, but there have always been trans people. And there was a consistent fear back in the early days of sports that if a woman was too athletic, she would spontaneously turn into a man.
So at the time, in the 20s and 30s, and even into the 40s, there was this idea called balance theory. And you have to remember, this is before we really know very much about human chromosomes. So they had this idea that every person was born with basically like a little bit of man stuff and a little bit of lady stuff. And your balance was what sort of made your sex or gender. And so they believed that you could be kind of a 65% woman or a 90% woman. And what they worried about is that if you were already kind of maybe a what they called a borderline case, somebody who was maybe only 65% a woman, if you did things that men do, like, for example, play elite sports, you could actually shift your balance and you could tip over into maleness, quite literally turn into men. At the time, you see local newspapers reporting this where people would allegedly get sick, right? Get really sick, and then they would get better, and that sickness will have tipped them over. And so you'll see these sort of amazing articles where they say, you know, like Johnny got really sick and now he's Jane, and that's fine. And we're all fine with that because we all know that's a thing that can happen, is you get sick and it tips your balance and then you become something else. And so you see these stories essentially of transition happening, but blamed on sickness that kind of balances, tips the balance. And so there was this worry that if you took these, again, borderline cases and you allowed these women who were already kind of maybe close to the edge of being men and you allowed them to compete in sports, they would accidentally turn themselves into men, and they needed to be protected against that.
Yeah, and at the same time, you know, the newspaper articles of people transitioning, when I read them, they weren't as horrifying as I thought. And in fact, there was almost more of an acceptance of trans identities than there is now.
Yeah, it is always a little bit both incredible and sometimes depressing when you see something like this, where you realize that perhaps, you know, 1920s ideas around acceptance of trans people are maybe we're in a better place than we are now, you know, not always great. And also, it's sort of interesting, right, because obviously balance theory is not like correct, quote unquote, scientifically. But in some ways, it's actually spiritually or like philosophically much closer to the realities of human sex biology, right, which is that it is a spectrum. There are all sorts of variations. It is not this really rigid binary where there is XX, XY, testosterone and, you know, estrogen. Like, you know, today I think people really have this sense of a very rigid, dichotomous, you know, sex binary. And that's not true. And in fact, balance theory, while certainly not accurate, is maybe a framing that is slightly more true in the spirit of the thing, in the sense that we have this spectrum that we're talking about.
Okay, so we have this 1% to 2% gender variation that is possible among all humans across all races, right? But you mentioned in your podcast that all of the women you talked to who were pulled aside for testing were Black and brown women from the Global South. So what's going on here?
Yeah, I think it's a huge piece of this conversation. I think there are a couple of reasons why, when it comes to specifically people who are being flagged for what are sort of broadly called DSD, differences of sex development. When we talk about women who are being flagged and suddenly being told, like Khalif saying, like, you don't look like a woman, we're going to force you to test. As far as I know, there are no white women who have been in the last, since 2009, who have been flagged in this way. And I think there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that in most sports, these tests are not blanket tests. So we are no longer testing every single woman the way that we were in the 60s through the 90s. And so what that means is that there are only certain women who are being flagged as quote unquote suspicious. And that accusation often does come down to visuals, what somebody looks like. And there's a really long history of racist assumptions about who looks like a woman and what womanhood looks like, what femininity looks like. There is a very long, well-documented history of white supremacy essentially telling people that Black women, brown women don't look like women, that they look actually like men.
For example, non-white, non-Western women can sometimes have more body hair. That is enough to get you flagged for gender testing.
There's also, I think, another element here, which is sort of healthcare disparity. So in general, on average, and these are sort of sweeping generalizations, but babies that are born in the Global North tend to be born in hospital settings and tend to be going to pediatric checkups and kind of have these what they call touch points to care, right? They're going to the doctor more. And in that case, often that means that if you do have some of these variations in sex biology, you might be diagnosed early.
And they're sometimes treated for it, which is highly controversial in of itself. Many women in the Global South don't know that they have a difference in sex development until they're suddenly tested by the IOC. But that might be changing.
Because we're seeing a shift in the ways in which the Global North thinks about these kinds of treatments, right? Because often those treatments involve things like genital surgeries to try and make them more like one or the other sex. And those are unnecessary and, you know, in some ways damaging. And so maybe I've heard people speculate that in 10 years, you're going to see a bunch of white folks who get into the same position where they're 18 and suddenly being told, actually, you have this thing and actually you need to, you know about it or change your body in some ways. And it will be very interesting to see if that changes the conversation that we're having right now. But that's another thing that's going on. So it's kind of both things in concert with one another.
Yeah, and again, given the variability in humans, why is there this extreme focus on women? Have men ever been scrutinized? I mean, there are probably men with low testosterone or high testosterone or intersex men competing in the Olympics too, right?
No, men do not get questioned. Men can have as much testosterone as they like. Good for you. And that's fine. And the reason for that, when you ask about this, the reason that you get is that the male category is not a protected category. The women's category is protected. And we need to protect the women's category, because if we didn't, then men would enter women's sports and they would win everything, because men are better at sports than women. And so we need to protect the female category, because otherwise it would be unfair to the real women who are competing in these groups. Because if you allow men or people with what they call male-like bodies or whatever other euphemism you want to use here to compete, it won't be fair.
Okay, so I've heard this before about the protected category. So the idea is that someone is secretly a man and that they're unfairly trying to win medals by competing in the women's category. So we have to make sure that everybody in the women's category is actually a woman. My question is, has that actually ever happened?
At the elite level, as far as we know, no. So, you know, obviously there are like road races wherever, you know, who knows. But at the Olympic level, as far as I know, and I've been reporting this for many, many years, 10 years now, and I've talked to as many historians as I can, we have no evidence of any case of a man, quote unquote, masquerading as a woman. Now, we do have cases of women pretending to be men to compete because they've been barred from things like the marathon. So we do have cases of the reverse happening, but we do not know of any cases of at the elite level. Level of men pretending to be women to compete.
Okay, so given all of this information, I have one final question for you. The binary in sports seems like it's pretty limiting. It also ignores a lot of human biology and sexual development. So how do we deal with this in the future? Do we get rid of the binary, or do we change the way that we organize athletes in, I don't know, weight classes or something?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. And I think there are kind of different layers to it, right? And so I think the sort of baseline level is that if you're a woman, you should be allowed to compete in the women's category. And that, to me, goes for trans athletes as well as for, you know, athletes with DSD variations and all of that. Then there's this question, I think, of non-binary athletes, right? And I think there are, in some cases, it makes sense to give a non-binary category, right? For example, a couple of marathons and half marathons have opened up a non-binary category, and that's great. That is not something that you should force someone into. I've seen people suggest that, you know, these intersex athletes or athletes with sex variation should be just given their own category. And that feels quite othering, I think, to those women who say, you know, all the women I talked to for Tested, they say, but I'm a woman. Like, they don't have any questions about their gender. They don't have gender dysphoria. But I also think that more big picture, when we talk about, like, what is the future of sports, it may be that in some sports, we should not have a gender binary and then everyone should compete together. It may be that in some sports we should, or that maybe we should think about dividing sports by some other category like height or, you know, weight classes like they do in boxing or something like that. And so I think that there are so many potential ways to think about this that can be really interesting, but that are hard to get at because we spend so much of our time debating the human rights of, you know, people who are don't fall neatly into these categories. And so I think there's all sorts of really interesting things that we could potentially talk about, but we're just not there yet because we're so stuck in this other muddy part.
That was Rose Eveleth, producer and reporter for the podcast Tested. There is a lot we didn't get to cover, but if you're listening and want to know more, please visit our website, focmedia.org, to get links and behind-the-scenes information. And because we started the show with Imani Khalif, we just wanted to end with an update.
This is what the years of work is about. This is what the early runs and the late sparring are about.
In the final of the women's welterweight division, Imani Khalif, the Algerian, fought Yang Yu of China.
Gold to the winner.
And in a unanimous decision from all five judges, Khalif won gold.
Gold medalist and Olympic champion.
Victorieuse au point par décision unanime, médaillé d'or et champion olympique.
In red from Algeria, Ima Khalif.
But it's not the end of the controversy over her gender.
The Algerian boxer filing a criminal complaint with Paris prosecutors to get to the bottom of the, quote, misogynistic, racist, and sexist campaign against Khalif, according to her lawyer.
Khalif specifically names Elon Musk, J.K. Rowling, and J.D. Vance, and she doesn't have to prove her gender in court. This is not a defamation hearing. She's taking them to court for online harassment. It's a big deal in an era when athletes' lives can be ruined over social media. and we'll be following the court case and we'll bring you updates as soon as the case is resolved.
Can you really place a monetary value on a musical experience like listening to John Lee Hooker play the blues? It might be difficult, but I want you to give it a try. You know what your television experience is worth, though sometimes you might not agree when the cable bill comes every month. And if paying anywhere from $5 to $15 a month for your TV streaming experience is indispensable, how about donating a few dollars a month to the station that brings you some of the finest blues, jazz, reggae, world dance, and Latinx music? Not to mention the coverage we bring you on arts and culture. Yes, even our unique music and arts shows need your support to keep us on the air. And when you give, you too keep our fearless journalism going as well. Support independent, fearless radio. Give now at kpfk.org or call 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-5735. Because KPFK is priceless.
Can't you see hard times are here to stay?
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And coming up next,
we'll present the documentary, She's Beautiful When She's Angry, a reflection on the rise of women's liberation movement in the United States between 1966 and 1971. She's Beautiful explores the emergence of a political thought that challenged systems of patriarchy. This documentary provides important historical insight at a time when our country is experiencing regression around issues of reproductive rights, equity in the workplace, and violence against women.
The argument has been over for a very long time. Yes. To have the right to choose. Yes. We should be mad. Are you mad?
Yes. You're not allowed to retire from women's issues. You still have to pay attention because somebody's trying to yank the rug out from under you. And that's what's happening now.
The feminists who are here tonight, do you not believe a woman's place is in the home, right?
As feminists, what we believe in is very simple, and that is the social, economic, and political equality of the sexes. Because the relationship between the sexes is, in fact, a political relationship. We're an oppressed group, and we have been through history. We have to.
If you do something as remarkable as changing the relationship between the sexes, everything is at risk, every possible idea. And many people don't like it, especially men don't like it. They're very threatened by it.
Women's lib really is a lot of insignificant people that are really trying to gain their own interests and boost their own ego by making brash statements or being on television or what have you.
You're so oversensitive, Audie. Why are you so sensitive?
We don't like being so sensitive. It's not pleasant. We don't like having to always be catching things. We'd rather they didn't exist. But as long as people are going to be insensitive to our position, we're going to have to keep correcting them because there's no other way to change the consciousness.
Women, given their educational status, can earn 60% of what men of the same education can. What that really means is that a woman with college education, BA, earns what a man does who has 3 years of high school. This is economic discrimination and exploitation.
Women as well as men told me I was wrong over and over again. Women are not oppressed. Or what does it matter? Who cares? You have a lot of influence. You were working against cultural norms. You're working against institutions.
How do you feel about women's liberation?
Woman's place is more at home than to advance herself too much.
Totally against it. I feel I don't know what they're being liberated from.
many women protested that they like cooking and housework and catering to men. But I would argue with some woman who was being extremely defensive about the movement and then 6 months later would run into her at a demonstration.
Prior to the women's liberation movement, most women were conditioned to meet the needs and expectations of men, but the introduction of this new feminist thought allowed women to view themselves as full human beings, equally capable of defining themselves and deciding their own paths. As the civil rights movement dominated the world center stage, women weren't content with being excluded from the conversations of resistance and liberation. Their issues needed to be prioritized as well, activist Frances Beale.
The Black Liberation Movement had come into its fore, and you're talking about liberation and freedom half the night on the racial side, and then all of a sudden men are going to turn around and start talking about putting you in your place.
If you don't want any trouble.
That was the contradiction in terms that we were no longer prepared to put up with. So 1968, we founded the SNCC Black Women's Liberation Committee to take up some of these issues.
A number of women felt that we need to go off on our own and focus on what we needed to do in our fight for liberation.
I was a graduate student at Berkeley. And one day I saw a little 3x5 card in the student union, and it said a women's group forming. And these consciousness-raising groups spontaneously grew up in many areas of the country.
When I first heard about the women's liberation movement, I had two little kids under 5. My connection with the world was, I felt, finished. During one of my crises of feeling that my life was over, I heard some young women talking about meetings they were having, and they were talking about women's liberation, and they gave the address of a meeting. So I went to this meeting, and there were these women talking about their lives as I had never imagined people could.
Well, you need to be specially trained to be a housewife. You get married, there's a whole new set of rules. We still have to look a certain way and be a certain way. But there's a whole lot more.
We went around the room, and people asked a very simple question. How would your life have been different if you had been a boy?
Why do you think being a woman might limit you as a human being, your possibilities, you know?
Welfare people and whatnot.
We challenged concepts of masculinity. We challenged concepts of femininity. We talked about skin color, how young black women would put cream on in order to make themselves light-skinned.
Suddenly, everything was up for questioning. Women did all of the family and housework and cooking, and the men got to make the living and get all of the attention in the world. Why was that?
Like, we don't even realize what goes on until we sit and compare with other women.
And we heard each other. We heard each other into speech. You could sense it. You could feel it. You could cut it with a knife, as they say. The room was electric with whatever was going to be shared.
So I said, I've had 3 abortions, and the last one was within the last year. And I started to cry because I suddenly understood that I wasn't alone, that what I had considered personal embarrassment was something that was part of this whole larger experience.
The big insight of the women's movement was the personal is political. Problems that you felt were happening to you alone probably were your fault. But if it's happening to other people, then it's a social problem and not just a personal problem.
The framing of women's oppression as a societal construct put all the daily personal challenges that women faced into a new broad context. For the first time, women were openly broaching subjects that generations before were too fearful to speak of. Women were demanding the right to control their own bodies and lives without permission from men or the state.
Thousands of women in the United States are hospitalized each year because of post-abortion complications. 5,000 of these women die.
I had a very good friend in high school who went away to college, and she subsequently had an illegal abortion and died. So within 3 or 4 months of going off to college, she was dead.
People tried to self-abort. My best friend took pills, and she had the miscarriage in the dorm shower with the turned on really hard, hoping the noise would muffle her cries of pain.
Some were able to find an abortion. Some had to have the child that they didn't want. All those kinds of experiences we discovered were universal. And abortion became our big unifying issue.
Women have a fundamental right to control their own bodies and to control their own lives.
Our bodies, our lives, our right to decide.
Not since the suffragettes fought for the right to vote has an issue been more critical to women than abortion.
Somewhere around 1970, I went to an abortion rights rally in San Francisco. And it was a sea of white women, very few women of color. And someone grabbed a bullhorn and asked for the African-American women who were there to gather under a tree. And we decided that we would form a group called Black Sisters United. I was very glad that, you know, somebody called African-American women together and said, you know, maybe we have something to talk about that might be a tiny bit different from what's coming from the stage. And indeed we did.
I was invited up to Harlem to speak at a event around abortion. Remember, in the Black Liberation Movement, the big debate is abortion is genocide, women should have babies for the revolution. And I remember going up those stairs, and my knees were literally knocking because this was a bunch of nationalists, and I was really scared. I concentrated a lot about the deaths of Black women as a result of illegal abortion and how we should be able to choose when we want to have children. So I managed to survive, you know, some of the attacks. And on my way out, twice it happened. One woman said to me, whispered to me, "Thank God you speak up. Thank God you're speaking up." And another, as I was approaching the door, said, "Right on. Right on."
Dear brothers, poor Black women decide for themselves whether to have a baby or not have a baby. Black women are being asked by militant Black brothers not to practice birth control because it's a form of whiteys committing genocide on Black people. Well, true enough. But Black women in the United States have to fight back out of our own experience of oppression, and having too many babies stops us from teaching them the truth, from supporting our children, and from stopping the brainwashing, as you say, and fighting Black men who still want to use and exploit us.
It was very difficult for middle-class white women to have any conception about what was going on in communities of color. And those differences could have been in conversation with each other, but if there isn't even an acknowledgement that there's differences in experience and perspective, and the voice of one is used as the voice of all, then you have a problem.
That was during a period when Black women did not particularly identify with the women's movement.
Mrs. Norton, why are you a Black woman involved in women's liberation?
I'm involved in the struggle for women's rights because I believe women are disadvantaged. Black women are no less than white women. Indeed, Black women far more than white women. Women who have spent their lives working in other women's kitchens have a different kind of handicap than women who have been oppressed for their sex in other ways.
We were grappling with that idea of how do you integrate race, class, and gender. That's the reason why we had some reservations about the term feminism, because feminism was just seemed to be dealing with the female aspect of your being.
It's important to keep in mind that black women are organized in their own organizations, in their own version of black women's liberation.
In 1964, a friend mentioned that his sister was pregnant and nearly suicidal. Could I do anything about it? And I was referred through a series of connections to a doctor. Asked him if he would perform an abortion. He said yes. And a few weeks later, someone else called and said they also were looking for an abortion. The word had spread. And at that point, I decided to set up a bit of a system. I was living in a dormitory at the time. And so I told people to ask for Jane. I could tell within the first minute what they were calling about, because there was a pause, there was a hesitance, there was a tension. Many were frightened, because three people discussing an abortion in those days was a conspiracy to commit felony murder.
Jane was this service that was established in Chicago that provided abortions when abortion was illegal. We would have women call us who were in need of the abortion service. And, of course, having Jane available without having to refer them to the mob was a godsend.
The group would take in the calls, and we would do counseling. Then women would be brought to specific houses on a rotating basis where the procedures would be done.
The service moved every day from somebody's home to somebody's home, which is quite amazing.
I joined the abortion service because I knew that women are sometimes desperate and they are going to hurt themselves in order to end their pregnancies. When I began Jane work, a few dozen women a week were coming through. After about 6 months, there were at least 100 women coming through. Ultimately, one really good abortionist taught Janes how to do abortions with skill and care, and then those Janes taught other Janes. All of us were always aware that what we were doing was illegal, that we could go to jail. You might have to throw everything in your bag and run down the back stairs at any moment. But we understood that it was important work, useful work, necessary work.
What is the relationship of the movement to the whole question of motherhood and the affection of mothers for children and so forth?
It's about being able to have children if you want them and being able not to have children if you don't want them. And if you want to have your kids at daycare centers, if you want to work, then you can do that too.
In the women's movement, the myth was that we hated men, we hated marriage, we hated children. That's not right. The group I was in, we talked mostly about childcare being the absolute precondition for women's emancipation.
One of the earliest battles was for childcare. It's a now statement of purpose. We knew that women could not hold jobs and be promoted until society recognized its obligation to help take care of our children.
And I remember at some of the early demonstrations, those who had kids, we would bring the kids. And people would say things like, oh, we can't talk with you nursing the babies and stuff like that. And we would say, show us the daycare center. We'll be happy to bring the kids to the daycare center.
Feminists are accused of wanting women out of the home and leaving children come what may.
We proclaim that when we talk about 24-hour child care, we mean to have
after a great deal of work where feminists were in the leadership, we got close to having a real child care system.
In 1971, amazingly enough, the women's movement, the Congress, the Senate, passed a comprehensive child care act. Most historians don't even remember that. Forget about the rest of society. And President Nixon vetoed it. He said, we don't want to make our women like Soviet women. We want women to take care of their own children.
That was a tragic moment in history. And we've been paying for it ever since. It's one thing for women to pay the price. It's another thing for generations of children to pay the price as well. I can think of, frankly, of no more important issues that early feminists raised than educational child care.
Poor people, black women, women on welfare, are often sterilized against their will. I mean, that's been known to happen.
The same hospital that wants to sterilize the black women will not let a middle-class white woman be sterilized. If she says, I don't want to have any more children, they say, you have to
be crazy.
You've got to tell me
you have to
have a medical reason. You have to be sick. There has to be something wrong with you.
Those things are two ends of the same dimension. It's still the issue of control over one's body, whether it's the right to have children if you want them, or the right not to.
That means over one-third of the women are never going to be able to hold a baby in their arms.
Women in Puerto Rico were used as guinea pigs, as a way of controlling the population. And then with that sterilization program being brought to New York City, we actively organized raising the consciousness about this. The Young Lords Party was dedicated to issues affecting Puerto Ricans in the United States. We were the first ones to begin to articulate an idea of reproductive justice. It's just as important for women in our communities to be able to have children, raise children that don't go hungry, have daycare, as well as have access to birth control and the right to a safe abortion. The kind of developing feminism that we had in the Young Lords was make very clear decision not to separate, to wage struggle internally with our brothers. The men had written this program. One of the points dealt with revolutionary machismo. What an oxymoron. We weren't having it. So we formed a women's caucus and made demands on the men in the organization. It was ultimately changed to, we want equality for women. Down with machismo and male chauvinism. It was important that it's not just women making that statement. It should be men saying, yo, brother, that's really a macho attitude you're taking. You need to check your... And that's what happened.
You're listening to the documentary, She's Beautiful When She's Angry, a reflection on the rise of the women's liberation movement in the United States between 1966 and 1971. Produced by Pamela Bull, Elizabeth Driehaus, and filmmaker Mary Doerr. This is Making Contact. Subscribe to our podcast or sign up for updates by logging on to our website at radioproject.org. You can also join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Now back to the documentary, She's Beautiful When She's Angry.
One evening in my Tuesday night consciousness raising group, West Village One of New York Radical Feminists, Diane Crothers walked in with a newspaper, It Ain't Me Babe, from San Francisco, and said, there's an article here we all have to read. And it was a story about a woman in Marin County who'd been raped during a hitchhike. We read the article and we went around the room, and it turned out one woman, Sarah, had been raped. And the police said to her, who'd want to rape you?
A friend of mine was raped at knife point in her bed in off-campus housing. I went with her to the Student Health Service, and she was given a lecture on her promiscuity.
It was very common in a courtroom to blame the woman for the rape. And rape was looked at as a crime that occurred because a man had strong sexual urges that he couldn't satisfy any other way. And it was only with the feminist women that it came out that rape is not a crime of passion. It's a crime that expresses the urge to dominate.
People who are not used to thinking of rape as the political crime against women. That was our slogan. Rape is a political crime against women.
I think the most profound thing that feminism did for me was to make me feel that I was capable of genuine freedom. Before the women's movement, I had my own work. I knew I wasn't going to live a traditional woman's life. I felt that I probably wasn't going to have children. And ultimately, I did have my daughter. And I think, were it not for feminism, I don't think I could have done that.
Right after I got out of college, it was November 2006. My mother passed away, and I got all of these letters and emails from her friends, her colleagues, all of the feminists that started Women's Liberation Movement. And I started to realize that even though I was down with the word feminism, I didn't really know what it meant to me and to our generation. I think the sexism that we experience is a little bit more insidious, and it's harder to sort of point out and say, see, that's sexism. But I know a lot of young kick-ass feminists out there. They're blogging, they're out in the streets, they're organizing. There's this new movement called Slut Walk that has now swept 70 different cities. And it was started by a young woman who heard a cop say about a woman who was raped, well, she was asking for it, she was dressed like a slut.
Believe it or not, people are assaulted regardless of what they wear. Some people who get raped are in burqas.
Rape is a felony!
We created a revolution that we are still debating in our society. We're still arguing over many issues that women raised 40 years ago, like abortion, like childcare. We still don't have any childcare.
In terms of reproductive health, reproductive justice, we've gone backward in a big way.
The bitter lesson is that no victories are permanent. All our rights are like that. They're only as good as we maintain them.
This fight is not over. This fight is not
over. Again, that's the documentary, She's Beautiful When She's Angry. Special thanks to the film's producers, Pamela Bowl, Elizabeth Driehaus, and director Mary Doerr.
And we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. And thanks to all of the contributors today, especially to Making Contact Radio. Feminist Magazine is produced by a coalition of feminist volunteers. Don't forget, you can find all the links from our program today on our website, feministmagazine.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter and sharing behind-the-scenes photos on Instagram. Or just email us, oldschoolstyle, @feministmagazine@yahoo.com. Our programs are archived in the kpfk.org audio archives. You can find our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, too. Today's intro music was by Maya Jane Coles. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from the Will Gear Theatricum Botanicum, returning June 1st through October 20th with outdoor repertory theater and educational programs for all ages. The Theatricum's signature production of Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream is back alongside The Winter's Tale, Wendy's Peter Pan, a fresh take on the J.M. Barrie classic of A Boy Who Wouldn't Grow Up, Tartuffe Born Again, a new translation and adaptation of the Molière masterpiece, and the Hispanic, Latino, Latina, Latinx, Latine Vote. The Wilgear Theatricum Botanicum is located in the heart of Topanga Canyon, just off the 101 freeway in the shade of the California Live Oaks. For further information and tickets, visit www.theatricum.com or go to kpfk.org.
Hi, this is Jack Eid from Eco Justice Radio. Check us out on KPFK at our new time, Thursdays from 4 to 5 p.m. Join us as we present environmental and climate stories from a social justice frame intended to amplify community voices, broaden the reach of grassroots movements, and inspire action. That's Eco